The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Good afternoon, everyone. Glad that you're here. My name is Paul Allaire. I'm a proud graduate of the LLM program, 1984. Originally from Belgium, but then that 1 year here at American kind of changed my life, and I ended up staying in the United States. So I've been here quite a while. I'm now a partner in the Midwest law firm called Thompson Hine, a law firm of about 400 lawyers. I'm in the Cincinnati office. If you're curious about how I ended up in Cincinnati, you can come and see me tonight. Be glad to share the story. This afternoon, we've got a great panel for you. We're going to talk about combating bribery and other suspect payments in international transactions. And the format of our panel discussion this afternoon is that we're going to have a brief introduction by the panelists on their own background and what the corruption atmosphere or way of business is in their particular country. And then we're going to go to Nancy, who's going to talk about the international framework from a convention perspective. And then we're going to go back to the individual countries and see how these laws are implemented in a country-by-country basis. And in the final stage of the program, we're going to talk about some other non-foreign government bribery issues, meaning commercial bribery. This is also quite important for many companies. So with that said, let's go to our panel. We've got a great panel here this afternoon. Rather than me taking up the time, I'll ask each of the panelists to introduce themselves, say a few words on their background, talk about their country, and as I mentioned. So, Rob, why don't you kick it off?
Thank you, Paul. Make sure I'm speaking into the microphone. My name is Rob Starr. I'm an associate director with a firm called Greenwoods. We're based in the UK, have two offices, one near Cambridge and one near a little place called Peterborough. I'm a former prosecutor for the Serious Fraud Office and was involved with a number of corruption cases over the 5 years that I was prosecuting there. And since then, I've turned to the dark side, and I now involved in a lot of regulatory compliance and defending and advising companies where I can. Now, in terms of the bribery and corruption environment in the UK, it's fairly straightforward. We're incredibly honest. Our politicians are reasonably honest. And our bankers are fantastically honest. So we've got nothing to worry about. But the reality is we're sort of working in a very changeable background at the moment. We've got some new legislation that came in last year, which no doubt I'll talk about shortly, called the Bribery Act. And it's in its infancy at the moment, but it's made some massive changes. The UK approach to bribery and corruption up until the Bribery Act had been completely wishy-washy. Our legislation was spread over 12 different statutes. It was very confusing, very difficult to prosecute people, and it was about 100 years old. There were lots of loopholes for clever lawyers like us to try and work around, and consequently very few cases and very few prosecutions. Ridiculously, we didn't even have the ability to prosecute matters outside of the UK jurisdiction until post 9/11, when we tabbed something onto some new terrorism legislation in 2002. We didn't have our first overseas corruption case until July 2009, but that doesn't really mean that we've been sort of crystal clear in the UK. We've had lots and lots of examples of individuals involved in corrupt activity. We also have quite a significant picture of civil recovery. So prosecutors have been very reluctant, particularly the last director of the Serious Fraud Office, to actually engage in what they're meant to be doing, i.e. prosecuting, and they've been settling a lot of cases by just simply recovering the proceeds of crime. But the reality is that we do have fairly low instances of bribery and corruption in the UK. Certainly not a great deal coming in. Facilitation payments in the UK are very rare. I've not come across them, but if you like, the bigger threats are British companies going out into Africa, into the East, and paying significant payments out there. I mean, where we rank, we're 16th in Transparency International's Corruption Perceptions Index. We've been hampered by various issues domestically involving corrupt prisoners, involving a lack of transparency in political donations, and also a lot of sport. For some reason, there's a lot of spot fishing fixing, spot betting goes on, and a lot of corrupt payments involved in sport in our country. Now, hopefully next year that will improve. No doubt Nancy can tell me a bit more about this, but standing with the OECD and our approach to foreign officials is getting better, but we still have a number of scandals going on at the moment. So that's kind of where we are in the UK.
Great. Thanks, Rob. David?
Okay. My name is David Kukhalashvili. I'm from Russia. I obtained my LM degree in 2003. And since that time, I have been working in Moscow offices of many international corporations as an in-house lawyer, but then I was so tired to work for other companies, and 2 years ago, I established my own law firm. It's very difficult to speak about the corruption of the UK because I can tell you that you are living in paradise in comparing with Russia. So the situation in Russia actually is very complicated because based on this ranking of the Transparency International, Russia is on the bottom of this. On the list of these corrupted countries, and corruption in Russia is a very big obstacle for these companies doing business in Russia Federation. There are many reasons in Russia actually which stimulates the corruption, and first of all actually also it's traditions and some historical facts, but one of the most important reason is a lack of one of the most important is that very complicated legislation, because we have this legislation which are providing unreasonably wide limits of discretion to the authorities, and this gives them this reason actually for corruptions. And there are these provisions in legislation containing ill-defined, hard to implement, and burdensome requirements for these organizations and for these individuals. And of course, everything this stimulates the corruption. For example, recently actually I get a case. For example, I have a client from the United States, and they had some partners from Russia. They wanted to invest this money in this gambling business, and they made this joint venture company. They invested about $60 million. It's not a big money, but it was a pilot program, and their partners stole this money. Why? Because they bribed some officials from the bank. They did not have any rights, for example, to dispose this money, but they somehow managed to pay some bribes to this bank official, so this money was actually stolen. So this is the situation we have with Russian, but to say true, actually the situation is getting more actually better. Why? Because it's in Russia it's relatively easy for foreign companies, big corporations for doing the business. I mean these big corporations like the Boeing, Coca-Cola and other famous companies, because in Russia these local governments, they are supporting a lot. In Russia, for example, we have about 89 regions in the Russia Federation, and each region is trying to attract the foreign investors, and all of them they are enacted some local legislation to enhance this foreign investments. They are enacting some legislation which are providing the tax intensive, and also actually recently it was enacted legislation based on which these local governments are appointing some people from the local administration who is supporting the business to get all approvals, etc., etc. So I can tell you it's in my observations that the most difficult in Russia is for this is the most difficult actually in Russia is to make a business for local Russian companies, because it's easier for the local authorities to impose actually some pressure to actually for these companies to pay the bribe. But also I will tell you later about this new Russian legislation about the corruption, because I'm telling that the situation is getting improving because they enacted new corruption legislation. But this is actually from one hand it's very good, but for another hand actually it's also actually creating some problems, because for example if 2 years ago this bribe for this construction permit was about $1 million in Moscow, after the enactment of legislation, this price of the bribe get about $3-5 million. So this is a problem actually we are facing in Russian Federation. Thanks.
Great. Thank you, David. Michael?
Yes, hi. I graduated from the LLM program here in 2005. After that, I went to work for a law firm in Vietnam, first with Mary Brown Johnson Stokes and Master, and then now I'm with Telecki and Gibbons. Primarily during that time, I've practiced corporate and commercial law, real estate, M&A. Actually, you know, generally speaking, most corporate commercial lawyers in Vietnam, just because of the nature of the size of the legal practice there, general practitioners, we do everything. And so I've done labor, anti-corruption law and just about everything else that companies come across and have problems with. Of course, foreign investment and licensing as well. Vietnam is on the corruption scale is 116 out of 183 countries, so it's pretty bad. I don't know if Russia is below Vietnam or I think we're below China for sure. Just from your perspective, accession to the WTO in 2007, Vietnam has pretty much opened its door to Western investment or foreign investment for about 20 years. Before that, it was a pretty strict kind of a communist economy, centralized economy. So. You know, in preparation for the WTO commitment, a lot of laws were enacted, of course, including the laws on corruption. Vietnam is a member of the UN Convention on Against Corruption. In 2003, they enacted a legislation called the Anti-Corruption Law in 2005. They revamped their penal code in 2009 to reflect a very all-encompassing, very strict anti-corruption law. Basically, it's directed towards state actors. So basically, it doesn't involve private actors or people in a purely private transaction. But if you try to provide a material benefit to a state official to influence an official act, then it's corruption. It's very broad, and it's both under anti-corruption law and the penal code, and then you get jail time for it, and you know you don't really need to bribe somebody too much. The threshold level is any amount theoretically, but generally, you know, if you bribe somebody for over $100, then you're subject to two plus years of jail time, depending on how much, and then it steps up depending on how much more you bribe that person, and then under the anti-corruption law, there's a safe harbor for giving gifts on special occasions like funerals and Tet holiday, which is a kind of a Lunar New Year holiday, and the weddings and so forth. But that must be under $24. So it's pretty strict. Actually, it's more stricter than the FCPA. But the problem lies in Vietnam is the actual enforcement, what you really see on the streets, and which is virtually nil. You know, one reason for that is that although it has fairly strict anti-corruption law, there's no whistleblower protection policy under the laws. So, I mean, if you want to charge somebody powerful and you're just a normal employee or a state employee, it would be ill-advised to do so. You're not going to get any special protection under the law. The police there's no special number two. There's no special anti-corruption enforcement body. So you go to the state prosecutors, and they'll probably laugh at you. I mean, that's literally how I feel is going to happen. What's going to happen if somebody tries to be a whistleblower in Vietnam is that it's just. There's no legal protection for you, and there's no special agency, and if you go to the prosecutor, they're a very corrupt agency as well. So, in reality, corruption is quite prevalent throughout all of Vietnamese government bodies. Although, even though it is, surprisingly, you know, they're not always acting in a corrupt manner. It's kind of weird. And you wonder why, but that is you know, it's not. I don't want to leave the impression that it's so rotten that you can't do anything. I mean, I think the biggest thing for businesses is that when you try to license your foreign direct investment activity, you know, all foreign direct investment activity, including setting up an entity in Vietnam, it must be licensed, and to do that. You know, depending on what kind of activity you want to do, you'll have to probably go through the local licensing body, which is regionalized. I mean, at one time it was centralized all in Hanoi, so that's good. Because some are more liberal than others and less corrupt than others. But But then, depending on what you want to do, for example, if you want to do distribution, you'd have to get your local authority in Hanoi or Ho Chi Minh, wherever you're based, to approve you. But also, the Ministry of Trade in Hanoi would have to approve as well. If it's a certain product that involves health and safety, then other ministries will get involved, like the Ministry of Health might get involved. And so you can have quite often several, maybe 1 to 5 ministries or more in Hanoi getting involved in the licensing process. So each time all those ministries and anybody who has to might have a say in, and sometimes even, I mean, the law is very loosely written, so sometimes even like other ministries that should not be involved gets involved, or like departments, even though, for example, the Ministry of Trade might have approved your application, but then the Department of Trade in Ho Chi Minh might still object on some reason. And so it's a sort of a chaotic situation, but and with a lot of different government agencies getting involved, it makes it, you know, worse from a licensing point of view, or getting yourself started, and I think that's the biggest barrier. But once you overcome that, I think in general it's, you know, most businesses do not have do not face too much corruption issues as they move along in Vietnamese I guess market.
So we'll come back on the specifics of corruption laws in Vietnam at the later stage of the program. Francisco, why don't we set the table for what's going on in Mexico?
Thank you very much, Paul, for inviting me to speak, and delighted being here. Washington is a city which I always love to come. Sometimes I have no excuses to. But let me tell you that I am LLM 83. I am virtually the first generation. Of course, the the first generation is represented by Nuria Beltran. You would meet already met her. And I'm a partner of the Mexican law firm Goodrich, Riquelme & Asociados. We are a full-service law firm. I've been there for the last 28 years. I do corporate and corporate finance. Let me tell you about Mexico, what is the environment dealing with corruption in Mexico. You hear about that there was a case going on right now, investigated by the Mexican prosecutor offices as well by the U.S. prosecutor offices, dealing with the 24 million Walmart alleged widespread corruption. They have a very aggressive program to expand and to open stores. And of course, they spend this amount of money facilitating the opening of store by getting quick licenses, quick land licenses, quick environmental licenses, and now they are being investigated. According to the Transparency International, the 2011 Corruption Perception Index, Mexico, unfortunately, is not a clean country in matters of corruption. It averaged 3 out of 10. It means that it's 10 means that it's a country which is perceived as a clean country. Corruption, as far we understand, and maybe Nancy could clarify this issue. I'm not an expert in this matter, but I'm trying to do my best. Corruption for us is influence peddling, smuggling, bribery, embezzlement, private use of public goods, as well as occupational fraud, which is steal or misuse of company assets. You know, we have an umbrella organization, business organization, that is called the Mexican Coordinated Council. According to to a news interview made to the chair of this Mexican business organization. Businessmen spend 10% of total income in order to cope with this issue of corruption. I mean, to do business, to facilitate the way they do business. Another ranking, Mexico is in good rankings and sometimes in bad rankings, depending how you view it. And according to the World Economic Forum, we are ranked ninety-one in the corruption index. Let me tell you that Chile is the good guy in Latin America. It's 21. Just to give you an idea, USA 42, Brazil 61, Mexico 91, Argentina 113, Venezuela 131. They give you an idea how the world perceives Mexico. Unfortunately, we are 91. Let me tell you that besides the Walmart story, Mexico City, which is a million itself, surrounding area accounts for add to another 14 million, that the Mexican police, which was somehow corrupted, in the last 4 years, they changed, they fired 80% of the total police force. They changed like 10,000 policemen. So Mexico City right now is the safest city in Mexico, and you are welcome to come. I would leave the legal instrument that we have in Mexico to cope with corruption for the next turn. Thank you.
Thank you. Xiaoling, if you can set the table for China then.
Sure. Thank you, Paul, for inviting me to be here. And certainly it's a pleasure to be here. And my name is Xiaoling Zhou. I'm a managing partner of a Junhe Law Office, New York office. And our firm is a China-based, Beijing-based law firm, one of the first private law firm in China. Was founded in 1989. Currently, we have about close to 500 lawyers working in nine offices, mostly in China, one in Hong Kong, and New York. We have two offices in the United States, one in New York and the other in Silicon Valley. The one in New York, I was the one who came over to open it up in 1993, and has been since been operating here. And unlike the previous speaker, I didn't have a chance to speak here, to study at the American University. I have noticed that. although I also studied in American, I was sent by government to as the first group of students back in almost 30 years ago to study law here. Now, after graduating, I went back to work with the government, Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Beijing. Later, I joined this firm in 1993 and found our New York office. Now, in terms of environment and corruption in China, before the start of our session, I was asking David in which country, Russia or China, is the corruption more serious? We debated for a while, but in the end, there is no winner. Okay, but what I can tell you is, corruption in China is very serious. No doubt about that. According to the statistics of the Chinese Supreme Court, for each of the past several years, Chinese court system sentenced, there are more than 10,000 cases each year involving commercial bribery. And many people received very harsh sentences, even death sentences. In that sense, China, our legal system probably has the most draconian law in this regard, but still people do it. Even the high-ranking officials. And of course, this presented a very difficult situation for multinational corporations working in China. On the one hand, they have to face this, the environment there. On the other hand, especially in my experience, especially U.S. companies, they are perhaps being affected most, primarily because the enforcement of U.S. SPA, CPA in China. And part of my job here is actually to assist, handling U.S. FCPA-related work. Okay. Now, China has this legal system which basically involving a criminal code which punishes corruption. This has been in existence for many years. But traditionally, we did not talk about the commercial bribery. As you know, 30 years ago, there were not many commercial activities in China. So corruption was really, corruption really, let's say, relate to another type of situation. For example, people want to be promoted, right? They give bribes. That's what we call traditional bribery. But in more recent years, there is a new system of law in China called commercial bribery. And most cases these days happen under that system. What I can say in this regard, of course, we'll come back to the details. This corruption is very rampant. On the other hand, the Chinese government is very serious about tackling this issue. That's why you see so many cases each year involving government officials, multinationals, and private companies in China. So in terms of, in this regard, I can say that our system, anti-corruption law actually is broader than FCPA, in the sense that the law punishes not just the corruption, at the government officials or party officials, but also private individuals, private companies. And also our system doesn't have things like facilitating payments, exceptions, or affirmed defenses as available under the FCPA. So in other words, there are both similarities and important differences between Chinese anti-bribery laws and the U.S. FCPA. So that poses, a very, very complicated situation for multinationals operating in China. So we'll come to perhaps back to these details later.
Thank you, Xiaoling. So now that we've got the introduction from each of the countries, let me turn it over to Nancy. She's going to shed some insights on the international legal framework for combating corruption and how that has evolved. Nancy?
Thank you, Paul, and thank you for inviting me to join this panel. It's fascinating, and as the prior moderator said, I think it's a great opportunity to learn from each other. I'm a JD graduate of WCL, not for the legal studies, and I'm now back as an adjunct and enjoying it very much. With respect to the index that everybody has mentioned, I worked with Transparency International for about 17 years trying to build the U.S. chapter. Despite what it says in the program, I stepped down a year ago, so my affiliation is no longer there, although my heart is. But the index that everybody's mentioning, I should say, is a perception index. And the rankings indicate that the problem is not just in the countries that are represented here on this panel, but it is prevalent in much of the world. I think, I don't have the exact numbers, but I'd say 3/4 of the country ranked on that index score below 5 out of a perfect score of 10. So it's a problem everywhere. And for the past 20 years, there's been an effort to try to overcome the notion that corruption is just part of doing business. It's just the cost of doing business everywhere in the world. And there has been an effort to try to get consensus on what laws should be and to get countries to then enact those laws. The breakthrough landmark agreement was the OECD Convention on Bribery of Foreign Public Officials. This actually was a real sea change. It had been something that the U.S. government had tried to move forward for many, many years since enactment of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act that has been referenced here. That's a law in the United States that was enacted in 1977 that made it a crime to pay bribes to obtain or retain business overseas. That's a simplified version of it, but just to get a sense of it. And for 20 years, there was not another country in the world that had a similar provision. So there was a sense that American companies were operating on an unlevel playing field, and it would be nice if we could get get the rest of the world to do the same. TI's perspective, though, was that the bribes where they're paid was not just affecting business, it was affecting the people in the countries, very much the countries that are represented here today. It was affecting those people more than anyone. So the idea was to try to stem the payment of bribes by external companies coming into these countries. And the OECD Convention focuses solely on bribes to foreign public officials. It doesn't deal with the solicitation of bribes, nor does it deal with commercial bribery, which are all equally of concern. But the OECD Convention entered into force in 1999. It now has 39 parties, including almost all of the major exporting nations. Russia, as was mentioned, is the most recent to sign on to this convention. And it is very much similar, although not exactly the same, as the FCPA. Every party has to make it a criminal offense for any person to intentionally offer, promise, or give any pecuniary or other advantage, directly or indirectly, to a foreign official to act or not act in the pursuit of his official duties in order to obtain or retain business or any other improper advantage. So similar but a bit broader than the FCPA was at the time the convention came into force. It defines a foreign public official pretty broadly to include any official in any branch of government, so judges, legislators, and executive branch, as well as, importantly, state-owned enterprises, a big challenge for companies operating in the global market. It also covers officials of public international organizations, so a bribe to a World Banker, for example, to get a contract, a bank finance contract would also be covered. It has accounting provisions, much like the FCPA, so you shouldn't hide illicit actions off your books, have separate sets of books. And it calls for sanctions that are effective, persuasive, effective, proportionate, and dissuasive. And this kind of formulation that leaves it open to countries as to how they implement the convention reflects the sense of the parties that you should have functional equivalents. You didn't have to have identical implementation, but it should be functionally equivalent so that everybody was operating under the same rules. And in terms of prosecutorial discretion, again, leaving to countries the systems that were in place, but then expressly stating a big but, that prosecutorial discretion could not be influenced by national economic interest. Think about that with the importance of global competition. You couldn't favor companies that were important to your economy. You couldn't look into the potential effect upon relations with another state or the identity of the natural or legal person involved. So with due respect to my colleague here from the SFO, when you think about British Aerospace and the Al Yamama deal, this was an issue that was very much in the fore, whether the UK should have gone forward with that case or had they a basis not to. I don't think I'll take time to talk about the differences because we seem to be pressed. Suffice it to say that the U.S. had to amend its law to broaden coverage beyond not just the listed companies and domestic concerns, but to any person. That's pretty broad at this point. And it was not just to obtain or retain business, but in addition for any improper advantage. Contrast that with the facilitation payments that have been mentioned here. Those under U.S. law are an exception. They're supposed to be small and for routine functions that the government is supposed to provide anyway, not for things that you're not entitled to. So therefore, the convention commentary says we don't consider facilitation payments to be payments to obtain or retain business, so they're not expressly prohibited. Having said that, the commentary does say that these are illegal everywhere they're paid. We in the United States wouldn't like them to be paid here. We shouldn't be paying them somewhere else. And in 2009, the OECD adopted a recommendation saying that companies should simply prohibit them. I should just quickly add that while the OECD is the landmark convention on foreign bribery, we do now have a Council of Europe convention, criminal law convention on corruption, the UN convention that was mentioned, and an Inter-American convention on corruption. All three of those have provisions outlawing foreign bribery. But they also go further. Each one of them criminalizes commercial bribery, the payment by companies, among companies, for kickbacks, which is a very important part of the corrosive nature of corruption in international business. And they also criminalize trading and influence, as well as the demand side, extortion, solicitation, and abuse of function. More to say there, but just to say that in terms of enforcement, which is where the rubber meets the road, so to speak, the progress that we have that we'll hear about from my colleagues is due in large measure to a mechanism that exists for each one of these conventions. All the parties have agreed to have a self-assessment and then to have a peer review. They all come together and two countries review one country. Those reports which evaluate your written law and your practical enforcement, what do you do as a matter of actually carrying out the law, those reports are all online. And for those of you who counsel international business or are simply interested in this issue, I really commend them to you. Look on the UN, OECD, OAS, and Council of Europe websites. They are lengthy and really detailed reports on how countries are doing.
Great. Thank you, Nancy. So as Nancy mentioned, the U.S. Foreign Corrupt Practices Act does not address commercial bribery, whereas you heard some of the panelists mention that in their country it is addressed under their specific law. So in the next round, what I'd like to ask our different panelists from each of the countries is to highlight under their local law some of the major points that may differ from what U.S. companies know here in the U.S. or that may be different from other countries around the world. And again, we'll start off with Rob and go around the table. So Rob, why don't you talk about the UK Bribery Act to start?
Thank you, Paul. As Nancy mentioned, the OECD agreed that we should put something in place to sort out bribery in the UK. And what we did, we sat down and we thought about it for about 8 years. And then when we were busy thinking about it, we thought about it for another four and then brought in the Bribery Act. And just to be fairly clear and without repeating what Nancy said, one of the aspects of the Bribery Act is that there is a bespoke offence of bribery of a foreign public official, and I'm not going to go over that again. In effect, all of the bits that needed to be covered under UK legislation to comply with what the OECD wanted us to do have been ticked by and large with Section 6 of the Bribery Act. But the Bribery Act, it does cover commercial and public bribery. Section 1, and I will sort of skim over it very quickly because I have put some more detailed notes in if you have access to it. I've seen that it refers to tab 16 of whatever it is, but I have put some notes in there that give a bit more detail on this. But Section 1, in effect, outlaws the offering, promising, or giving of an advantage which will either induce or reward improper performance by an individual, or alternatively, in effect, compromises that individual in their position. We have a reciprocal offence as well. So it's also Section 2 says that it's an offence to request a bribe or to agree to receive a bribe or simply receive a bribe, or say a bribe, an advantage, if you like, it's termed. But that is in some way linked to improper performance as well. And there are four different scenarios set out in Section 2 that account for the timing of how that bribe may occur. Now, Sections 1, 2 and 6, which are those elements, they can be committed by individuals and companies. The law in respect of corporate liability is very similar to that previously, in that you require a director or a senior manager or a guiding mind to have actually been active in the corrupt elements. And then, in effect, the company liability is parasitic on theirs. That's part of the problem we've had for years in simply bringing corporate prosecutions. Now, other things to note from these elements of the Bribery Act, facilitation payments are unlawful. We don't have any form of exemption for that. It has quite a profound effect on corporate hospitality. That's not, if you like, reasonable business expenditure is not a specific defence or exemption under the Bribery Act. And my experience so far is this is the bit that all of our clients are getting so worked up about at the moment, because it's such a grey area. What is reasonable and proportionate is very difficult when you're dealing with a whole range of different sized organisations. In respect of jurisdiction, with these three specific offences, it can be prosecuted in the UK, obviously if it happens in the UK, but also to acts of bribery abroad, provided there is a close connection to the UK. So if it's a UK corporation, if it's a British citizen, or it's somebody that's ordinarily resident there. And one important aspect that has been added into this is that there is a, what's known as a consent and connivance provision. So if a company is guilty of corrupt behaviour, paying bribes, etc., but there were other board members and directors there that simply either allowed it to happen or turned a blind eye to it, then they can be punished as if they were active in the bribery offence itself. And that's quite useful when you come on to looking at things like penalties, because we have things like the Proceeds of Crime Act that can go back and take all the benefit they derive from it, and there's significant, if you like, personal issues that would be involved if directors are complicit in it. The offences carry a 10-year imprisonment sentence, not a death sentence like the previous Chinese ones, but 10-year prison sentence for individuals and unlimited fines, in addition to other things such as sort of debarment from EU procurement contracts and public sector contracts. But I'd say the biggest change and the thing that you probably need to take home from the UK Bribery Act at all is simply this. If you act for a multinational corporation that does business in the UK, has part of its business in the UK, then the Bribery Act, certainly you're within the scope of the Bribery Act. There is a new, what's known as the corporate offence, but it's under Section 7 of the Act. It's a failure to prevent bribery by a commercial organisation. And what that says is that a commercial organisation is guilty of an offence if an associated person pays a bribe in order to gain or retain business or an advantage in business. Now, it doesn't matter where in the world that bribe is paid, or if you like, who by, provided that person can be associated with your commercial organisation. Now, who is an associated person? Well, anybody that performs services for or on your behalf. So that captures, if you like, employees. It'll be assumed that an employee is performing services for or on your behalf, but it also captures intermediaries, consultants, anybody else that you're engaged with, joint venture partners. And that sort of adds on a completely new level, if you like, of diligence and if you like, rigorous examination of who you're getting into bed with, if you like. Very, very quickly, all I would simply say about that, it's a strict liability offence. The burden of proof falls on the company. If they can prove that a bribe has been offered under the provisions of sections 1 or 6, then it falls on the company to actually prove that they have procedures in place to stop it. I'll leave it there. The procedures are actually set out in my paper, but we're a bit pushed for time.
Before we go on, let me mention again, in the program that you received, there is an extra handout that lists the materials that are available for the entire conference. They're all available online. Printing these things is, you know, 20th century. We don't do that anymore. But there are some very nice materials from our panelists online, so I would encourage you to seek that out. And with that, I'll turn it over to David for some remarks on the highlights under Russian law, and then we'll move on with the rest.
As to Russia Federation, I can tell you that the anti-corruption legislation in Russia, the Russian government started developing anti-corruption legislation from 2008, and the Russian authorities initiated many reforms to fight the corruption, and these reforms include some preventive measures and also some repressive measures. And in Russia, for example, we don't have the one law like actually you have in the United Kingdom or in the United States, and this Russian anti-corruption legislation is more fragmented and contains many legislation. For example, in 2008 was enacted the law on contracting corruption, which defines the corruption. Also, in 2009 was enacted the law about this anti-corruption expert review of legislation. And also, we we have the public service law, and this law defines the conduct of the state officials and impose on them some restrictions. And also we have the administrative code and the criminal code, which provides this responsibility for this for corrupted people. And as I mentioned, this corruption in Russia is defined in the law, which was enacted in 2008. And the definition of the corruption in Russia it's more wide than the definition of corruption provided by UK and US law. And under the Russian law, the corruption is that abuse of power or position of authority with respect both to public servants and governmental officials, and to officials holding any management position in a commercial and other private entities. Also, corruption is giving a bribe or receiving a bribe by a public official, also by foreign officials or officials by an international organization. Also, corruption is considered as an engaging in commercial bribery, also criminalized under the Russian law. And also, the facilitating a bribe is also actually criminalized. Also, it's important to mention that in 2009 it was enacted the law by this government, the law about the anti-corruption expert review of law. And based on this law, in 2009, the Ministry of Justice of Russian Federation carried out anti-corruption review of thousands of federal and local acts and regulations. And bribe incentive factors were identified in almost about 10% of these reviewed acts and regulations. And all of these provisions of this legislation were amended. In Russia, actually, we have very severe liability for this corrupted people, and these liabilities are provided by the criminal code, and mainly actually as their responsibility is they can be So in Russia, actually, we have two kind of liability for these corrupted people. We have the administrative fines and we have the criminal fines. And in Russia, for example, under the Russian laws, these legal entities, they are not subject to criminal responsibility. That's why for these commercial briberies, for example, if these legal entities are paying actually this money to some state authorities, for them is provided by the laws these administrative fines. It's about this 100 times of this benefit received by this legal entity. And also for the individuals, there are actually the big fines. For example, in case of the giving of this bribe to these state authorities, the fine is about this 50 times of the amount of the paid bribes. Also, actually, under the Russian law, we have actually some remedies regarding these corruption activities. For example, if a legal entity possesses assets which were purchased from the individual found guilty of a crime of corruption, such assets are subject to confiscation by the government in case the company knew or should have known that this individual did not have the good title. And also, actually, in case of the corruption bribery, for example, if the corporate officer of the company pays actually the money to some corporate officer for other company in order, for example, to facilitating the process of signing of the contract, etc. In such case, it's possible to revoke this contract through the court. And in case of the revocation of this contract, then actually it means that the other party should return the money. And under the Russian law, for example, we don't have the specific body in Russia which is in charge of this monitoring of the anti-corruption legislation like you have in the United States or you have in UK. And all these penalties and responsibilities under the Russian law should be imposed by the court. So, for example, if there are some people who are actually accused in bribery, the act of bribery should be proved by the court, and only court has this right to define actually whether there was an act of bribery or not, and only court has this right to impose this responsibility of this person. And the court is entitled to impose this administrative fine as well, and also actually the criminal fines. Thank you.
Thank you, David. Michael, you want to give some highlights under Vietnamese law we need to be concerned about?
Okay, I'll try not to rehash.
Just the highlights.
What I said before. In terms of the actual coverage of what acts are covered under the bribery, it doesn't involve purely private transactions, it must involve a state official, and it's giving a material benefit to a state official for him to act or not act in a certain way. It's kind of like the FCPA. There's no safe harbor for facilitation. Almost everything is covered. Except for, you know, in the Penal Code, punishment starts after about $100. So below that, I mean, you might be still liable if whatever, even though it's less than $100, if it had serious consequences, which is a defined term under the law, with some guidance on what that might be. Also, I talked about under the anti-corruption law, there is a safe harbor for gifts to officials on a special occasion. So one thing to remember is that the Penal Code has both monetary fines and jail time, and that under the anti-corruption law, it's mostly, there's no jail time, it's just administrative fines. Under the Penal Code, only individuals are affected, so there's no corporate liability under the Penal Code. Under the anti-corruption law, corporations are affected. Under both systems, it affects the bribe giver and the bribe taker. Also under the Penal Code, the intermediaries and facilitators of bribes are also covered. And under the Penal Code, there is a capital punishment. That is an option under Vietnamese law for bribes over 14,000 U.S. There is capital punishment, so it's not that big. And then it's either 20 years to capital punishment. In reality, it's a lot different. There's very serious lack of enforcement. Only time that I really see any kind of enforcement is during political infighting. Recently, there was a fight between, there's apparently a power struggle between the prime minister and the president of Vietnam, in which they're kind of knocking out each other's lieutenants through the laws. Of course, there's enough laws. I mean, if you want to dig around for laws to knock somebody down and imprison them, there definitely are, including the corruption laws. And interestingly enough, you know, the one thing that you can do to have an effective corruption system is a specialized prosecution body for corruption. In Vietnam, there isn't any, and so what's happening in real life in this particular instance, which is active right now, is the prime minister controls a certain police body, and the president controls another, and there you go. They're using that to kind of hurt each other. So that's the reality. And also, one thing that is also reality is that there's no entertainment exception, but there's definitely very much customary in business in Vietnam to entertain public officials for various reasons. So with that, I'll leave it to
Francisco.
Thank you. Now, regarding Mexico, yes, we do have legal instruments to cope and to fight corruption, but believe it or not, they only are applicable when there is a government official involved. So they do not apply to commercial transactions or commercial dealings between private parties. We have a several statutes. We have the Constitution, 1997 Constitution. There's the instrument of impeachment for high officers. Then the criminal code, which said that when there is any government official involved in any particular transaction, he has been sanctioned with 2 to 14 years of prison, and of course he cannot could be free on bailment. There are laws on transparency and accountability for the government, and those laws deal with at the federal level with the administrative liabilities on public officials, the federal law on transparency and access of public government information, as well as the government general accounting law. Currently, as you may hear of, Mexico is changing president in December 1st, and the president-elect has announced that he's going to present law initiatives to Congress in order to make tougher the general accounting law as well as the transparency law, and so maybe next year we could pass you good news as to that we do have better instruments to cope with corruption. Just in June 11, the Mexican Congress passed a law dealing with corruptions in public procurement. So, as you see, contrary to what happened with our main trading partner, the U.S., we don't have an FCPCA law in place. We just have, I would say, at least one third of what the FCPA law regulates. This law, which is fairly new, deals with is trying to cap corruption in public procurement, and it sets it has been modeled after the FCPA, U.S. FCPA, as well as the U.K. Bribery Act. And of course, it has some of the guidelines of the OECD has been implemented into the law, and there are fines to individuals amounting to U.S. dollars U.S. 5,000 to 240,000. When there is a transaction regarding a commercial transaction, if there is a contract awarded and the party which the contract was awarded makes some corruption, the fine is 30% to 35% of the total value of the commercial contract. To legal persons like companies, the fine could go from 48,000 US to 9.5 million US. And of course, a company which has gained a contract by engaging in corruption acts, that company could be disqualified for future biddings from anywhere from 3 months to 10 years. So as you may see, legislators in Mexico has found that the biggest corruption is within the government, and they are doing whatever they can in order to minimize corruption, because that's something which you cannot extinguish. I think it comes with the society. We get corruption from the Spaniards that conquered us, you know, where there were prisoners that came to Mexico and conquered us, as well as the Aztecs. There were a lot of corruption among Aztecs. So how could you eliminate that? You have to put into place laws that could minimize corruption to a level which is reasonable. Corruption, I mean, this law, as I said, typically is pretty much the same as the FCPA, US FCPA, and there is a leniency provisions there that allows those parties participating in transactions, cooperating with in anti-corruption investigations, to get reduced fines from 50% to 70%. And I would comment some cases during next term, because I need to pass the microphone to my friend to my right.
Great, thank you, Francisco. Xiaolin, if you can add a few comments from the Chinese perspective.
Okay, just a little bit more on our system. As I mentioned, our criminal code contained penalties for bribery a long time ago. Actually, the code contains 8 subcategories for bribery and receiving bribery, including individual giving bribery, entities giving bribery, government officials, to state, non-government officials. So basically, you know, if someone gives a property to a government official to obtain illegitimate benefits or advantages in violation of law, that's called bribery. And receiving bribery, of course, is easy to understand. So most cases in China, you see, started with government officials or other people being prosecuted for receiving bribery. Then, of course, if there is people receiving bribery, there must be people giving bribery. So they would trace it to that, right? So now, under our criminal code, there was no FCPA type of provision until last year when China amended our criminal code to add a provision to punish act of giving so-called property to foreign government officials, foreign public, they call foreign public service personnel, or officials of a public international organization. The law is very brief, and there hasn't been any cases under that amendment yet, although there are tens of thousands of cases in China implementing our criminal code in terms of domestic violations. Now, that's basically traditional criminal anti-bribery law. In these days in China, actually, what's more irrelevant and what people hear a lot is really commercial bribery. What that means is we didn't have anything like that until about, I think, 20 years ago, when China promulgated its first anti-unfair competition law, which contains a provision which now is the basis for commercial bribery, which basically says business operators should not give cash or bank assets to counterparties in purchasing and selling products. That's one sentence. Out of that, you know, emanate so many regulations, separate implementing regulations. What happens is, if you are a pharmaceutical company, in reality, right, your pharmaceutical companies, you want to sell your products to hospitals, to patients, and you give some cash donations, you give some free products, you invite the officials of the hospital for sightseeing, that kind of thing. This, in eyes of the law, according to the law enforcement of authorities, all constitute commercial bribery. Okay, so then of course now in China, if you want to get a project, you give cash or property to officials or even to non-public officials in order to get a project, this could also constitute commercial bribery. So you can imagine in such environment, it's very difficult for multinational corporations to operate in China, because the environment in China is such, giving something like a small value is very common, as like a customer, right? But how to determine that? It's a very difficult thing to do. So very often we, 2 weeks ago, or 1 week ago, is China's so-called mooncake holiday, at which time, you know, you see most people give gifts, and the foreign companies operate in China also will give gifts to various business parties, government officials. So we have a lot of clients, U.S. clients, are calling, can our subsidiary in China do this? How much the value can it give? That kind of thing. Other times, in terms of enforcement, the commercial bribery enforcement is done mostly by an organization in China we call State Administration of Industry and Commerce. Its enforcement is every day, right? But most of its enforcement action is civil and administrative in nature, which means if they found the violations, they basically impose fines, monetary fines, against the companies, against the entities who have offered that, things in violation of commercial bribery. For U.S. companies, in our experience, from time to time, we receive call from general counsel, even sometimes, in-house counsel, saying their subsidiaries are being investigated in China by SIC for, so-called commercial bribery, which means basically a promotional, that their employees in China given promotional gifts, inviting their counterpart business parties to sightseeing, some meetings, some conferences, dinners, that kind of thing. Then they'll be investigated, and when the U.S. company are being investigated, and they have to report to their headquarters in the U.S. When the general counsel receive that kind of a report, they are in a dilemma. What dilemma? Whether to report. If they don't report, they fear, later something bigger would arise. Then they would, face more serious penalties or reinforcement in the U.S. But if they report here to the U.S. Justice Department or SEC, right away, they know some kind of investigation will ensue. All right. So now, sometimes our in-house counsel or general U.S. Company want us to give opinion as to whether such a thing, what the subsidiary did in China is legal or not under Chinese law, because there is a defense, right? It's a local law defense. If Chinese law allows that, then they're okay. However, the problem is, it's very difficult to say whether it's legal or illegal. There is no written law say you can give a gift worth $100, not $500. Now, nothing say that, but the custom, in terms of custom, it's very common. People just do that, right? Most time, there is no prosecution, no enforcement. And even if there are enforcement, as I said, in China, mostly done by SIC, which is civil and administrative at the most. However, there is no difference between being criminal and civil. It all depends on the circumstances. So that, you can see, posed a very serious issue for U.S. companies or other multinationals operating in China. And that's how we as Chinese lawyers come in all the time for this type of thing here.
And on that note, I'd like to turn it back to Nancy, actually, because what I'd like to hear from Nancy is how she has seen standards for the private sector best practices evolve, given this daunting international landscape of corruption laws or anti-corruption laws around the globe.
Well, it's challenging in a way to take on the assignment, because I can say a bit about how private sector standards and best practices have evolved alongside the evolution of the international legal framework. But when you hear what my colleagues have said about the reality on the ground in their countries, there is a question, I think, whether companies can actually operate with the kind of standards that are out there. But having said that, I would go back to this 1977 when the FCPA was enacted. It was at that point that the International Chamber of Commerce took up this issue and developed rules of conduct for combating bribery and extortion. So that's really, it indicates how long this evolution of private sector standards has been going on. Since that time, Transparency International put out its own anti-bribery principles. Those, in turn, were used as the basis for principles that have been put out by the World Economic Forum as well as by the UN Global Compact. And just to give you a sense of the coverage of these principles, the World Economic Forum has 170 companies that have signed on to their principles, and the Global Compact has something like 10,000 signatories. And their principles are very similar to principles that you might think are common practice. And I'd like to give just an example of that from the recently published OECD guidance for internal controls, ethics, and compliance. And I'm giving that because the OECD guidance was agreed by the OECD member countries, so it really carries a heavy weight for companies who are thinking about what kind of program do I want to put into place. To be able to look at the OECD guidance as a benchmark, I think, is very helpful. And in fact, the U.S. Justice Department, some of their people have said, we will give this great weight if this has been the guidance that you followed. specific measures, especially for those of you who are familiar with U.S. practice, seem to track fairly closely to the U.S. sentencing guidelines. They call for, let me just reel off a few of the qualifications, and I think they're probably pretty much common sense for lawyers advising companies doing business abroad. First and foremost, an explicit and visible expression of support from senior management to an anti-bribery policy. A clearly articulated prohibition with the related internal controls and programs. Senior management with authority and resources and autonomy to oversee the program, as well as to report to the board or to a board audit committee if there's a problem. Application of the program to gifts, just as we were speaking about, it's very much a mirror image of what our Chinese colleague was saying. If you give a gift as a pharmaceutical company to a Chinese hospital employee, you are paying a bribe to a foreign public official. So your program has to cover things like gifts, hospitality, travel, contributions, political donations, all the many ways in which someone might give to an official. It looks right, but actually it's really a subterfuge for a bribe. The program has to apply to all your directors, officers, employees, and third parties. And with respect to third parties, as Rob said, you should do due diligence and communicate to them what your program is all about. Have the financial and accounting and controls in place that one might expect to ensure books and records are accurate. Communicate and train all your people depending on their roles and responsibility. Discipline those that you find have gone astray and provide guidance to those who are seeking it even in real time when they're up against a situation. And finally, provide for internal and confidential reporting. That's whistleblower protection. These are the elements of the OECD guidance, and as I said, for those who've looked at the sentencing guidelines in the U.S., they will all be very familiar. The Justice Department, in fact, is about to come out, or has said it's about to come out for the past several months with its own guidance, which will pull together what's been done, what's been said here in the U.S. under our opinion procedures and in other ways that the Justice Department has issued its guidance. I think it's important to look at these if you are a company or if you are counseling a company and they say, why do I need to go to this trouble and expense? First, obviously, to mitigate the corruption risk to the company itself. Second, to potentially mitigate penalties under U.S. law and under the British laws we'll hear more about. If you have a good program, that could affect, reduce the penalties that might be imposed. And third, an effective program could even get you a deferred prosecution or end a debarment if you've been debarred for a violation. I'm going to leave. I did some looking at the UK guidance, and I don't want to preempt what Rob is going to say, but I thought, again, it was interesting that a lot of what is in the UK guidance also tracks closely to the U.S. principles of federal prosecution of business organizations, which says to me that there's this evolving standard, not just on the legal framework, but on what's expected of companies.
Thank you, Nancy. So in the 5 minutes that we have remaining, what I'd like to ask each of our five country specialists is the following. When you are advising your clients, your domestic clients, meaning for Rob, when he's dealing with UK companies that are working in internationally, do you advise your clients to put together a code of ethics and conduct that applies worldwide, or do you tell your clients put together a policy on a country-by-country basis? So global policy, local policy. What do you advise your local clients? And each has about 1 minute to respond.
I'll do mine very quickly then. I would, and what we have been doing is saying, well, draft a global policy based on all of the strongest principles that we can find from various bits of legislation, but by and large, we've simply been tailoring it from the procedures gathered under the bribe Bribery Act. I mean, as Nancy said, going through the guidelines, it all mirrors it. It's all best practice. It's all very similar. And provided that you're, this is all just going towards transparency and honesty. And you know, provided you work hard to get your policy and your procedures right, they're working, you test them, that should be applied across the board. If there are any specific concerns I would have, I would address them to that particular country. But I would go global on bribery acts.
David, what do you tell your Russian clients?
Absolutely agree, actually. So we can apply the global policies, but it's necessary also to take into consideration the local specifics. For example, as I know, based on the Foreign Corrupt Practice Act, these companies should, for example, maintain these records using the GAIP standards. But in Russia, for example, we are not using GAIP standards. We have our own local standards. And all the companies, foreign companies, doing which are doing the business in Russia, so they are maintaining their accounting books using the GAIP standard for their headquarters, and also actually they are using the local standards in order to file these documents to the local tax authorities. And also, for example, I want to tell you about the one case. It's also a very interesting case which happened in 2010, and one of the Danish company operating in Russia was fined by this Russian anti-monopoly service for the activity which is called which is described as an anti-corruption due diligence inconsistent with Russian law. And actually it was a very interesting decision. Why? Because this Danish company was holding the dominant position of the Russian market, and under the Russian law, this company who are holding the dominant positions, they are subject to some restrictions. For example, they may refuse to deal with some other qualified distributors and some other company only based on the grounds provided by the Russian law. And this Danish company was using the anti-corruption due diligence process as a reason to refuse to work with this one of this Russian company. And because of that, actually, this Danish company was fined, and the fine was about $3 million. So actually, it's necessary also actually to find this balance between all this anti-corruption regulations and this requirement of this local legislation.
Michael, what do you tell your clients in Vietnam, your Vietnamese clients?
Sorry. I think for multinational clients that I have, they have to have a global standard that would pretty much apply and be upheld in almost any jurisdiction, including England and the U.S. Most of my clients are American, so they probably at least follow the American standard. And sometimes, you know, the local laws, you have to look at them as well, because they're stricter than maybe a global standard. So that's on a case-by-case basis, look at the local law as well.
Francisco?
Yes, I would advise to our clients dealing operations overseas or from overseas doing operations in Mexico to really follow the U.S. Standards, the U.S. policies on Anti-Corrupt Practices Act. And of course, I said, well, even though they are not 100% applicable here in Mexico, unless there is a transaction which may have some point of contact in the U.S., but you take advantage of those and be prepared just in case the Mexican law, the legal framework, change. We have been following we are somehow behind the U.S. standards, but we are getting there. And in addition to that, I said, please make sure to have adequate internal controls, have an ethics code, compliance programs, and then have good reporting, periodical reporting. So, because you know you can have the policies, but you need to know whether they will work and they will really are useful for monitoring what you're doing, whether you are in compliance with local and U.S. law.
Xiaolin, you got the last 60 seconds here.
Okay. Well, I guess most of the Chinese companies have not put on the agenda put on the agenda how to comply with the foreign anti-corrupt law, corruption law, except some largest Chinese companies that are operating overseas, especially in the U.S. And we have advised some of them because they see those cases, and many of them involving many FCPA cases prosecuted in the United States actually involve Chinese companies. So some of the largest companies have started to take this seriously in their compliance program, like anti-bribery policy, code of conduct, employee manual. They put a specific program, specific guideline in it. Mostly focused on U.S. FCPA, I would say, but these days in some of the recent program, they also mention UK's Act, because that's new and that's broader. Still, they do not know too much because there have not been many cases yet. Our job actually mostly involving advising multinationals operating in China how to comply with the Chinese and FCPA, Chinese anti-bribery laws and FCPA, which involves a usually pretty comprehensive program involving auditing, involving making employee manual, code of conduct, and drafting standard anti-bribery provisions in their distribution agreement, that kind of thing, and also typically these days involving the effort to find out FCPA violations or any potential violations of Chinese anti-bribery laws in connection with the merchants' acquisition in China. So it's fairly comprehensive. In addition to that, many multinationals operating in China routinely conduct training for their employees on FCPA as well as the Chinese anti-bribery laws.
Thank you so much. Well, I think with that, we've kind of run out of time. The next program here is Trends in International Environmental Law. That should be quite an interesting discussion. In the meantime, please thank me and join me in thanking our panelists for their wonderful insights on combating corruption. And they will be available if you have questions. Please come on up and talk to them. And thanks again for coming.